It's McCowan. It's Shannon. It's the podcast for a, what day is this, John? Tuesday?
Tuesday. You golfing today?
I am not golfing today, unfortunately.
Because you've got, you are regaled with golfing clothing. Golf Canada. Well, your buddy Lawrence Canada Applebaum. Yeah, and your Titleist hat.
I have a Titleist hat on today.
I mean, what is this? I mean, are you just dreaming of a tea time or something?
No, I'm sucking up for advertisers. That's what I'm doing.
Okay, as long as we're clear.
Yeah. Like, you know, a sleeve of Pro V's is, worth its weight in gold. I may not play golf all year, John, you know.
I was going to invite you to play this weekend. You want to play this weekend?
My schedule, I'll have to check, but.
Your schedule. Give me a break. Why, do you have to skim the pool again?
You got to skim the pool every day now. The crap awful that is falling off the trees into the pool is just, it's ridiculous.
So do you want to play golf on the weekend or not?
Well, where are we playing? Well, maybe we shouldn't tell everybody here on this public forum, or we'll have, you know,
we'll have to
get crowd control.
Or perhaps the maybe the course would like to advertise with us, you know?
Well, there's a thought.
I know.
Which reminds me of a story, true story. So,
As opposed to a what kind of story?
A made up one. Which are the ones you tell? So
hold on. Now that's it's not the fair.
Listen, it's the early 80s, and I had interviewed Nicholas on a few occasions, and he seemed to be fond of me for whatever reason. Yes. So I'm invited to go with him. Well, not with him, but I'm invited to go to the old course at St. Andrews because they're opening the hotel on the 17th fairway of St. Andrews.
Right.
So this is the grand opening. Nobody's ever stayed in the place. And I think there were eight of us from around the world who were invited to go. And British Airways flew us over. And part of it was we got to play golf at the old course, and Nicholas and Ballesteros, who of course at that point was hot as a pistol, were going to play. So first day we're there, I get a tee time, or they arranged a tee time, and I teed it up and played the old course.
By yourself?
No, I played with, I don't remember how many people, it was probably foursome. I think Lauren Rubenstein and I played together, but I'm not 100% sure of that. Anyway, not the point. So I go and play. And the next day, Nicholas and Ballesteros are supposed to play. And after the round, I sit down with Jack at the Old Course Hotel to do an interview with him. And turns out they wouldn't let Nicholas and Ballesteros play the old course. So they had to go down to some goat ranch down the street.
They wouldn't let them play because it was not part of the open circuit that year, or what was the reason?
The old course hotel, or old course golf course, is a public golf course. They said that the organizers of this event had not arranged for crowd control. And so they wouldn't let them play.
Oh.
Which, I mean, I sort of get that. But have you played over there?
No.
You know, it's a public park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do know that.
And pedestrians, non-golfers, have the right of way.
Yes, they do, yeah.
So if you want to come from the old tune and go to the beach, and the beach is on the, right side of the first fairway, people walk across the first and 18th fairways to get to the beach and with their dogs, and you got to let them go. That's the rules and regulations. So I remember sitting down with Jack and I didn't go to wherever they went for this practice round. And I said, well, how was your game today? And he said, he was grumbling. And I said, they wouldn't let you on the old course. He says, no. And he said, did you play? And I said, yeah, I played here. Played the old course. He was madder than hell.
There was no need for crowd control for Bob McCowan.
None.
Well, I mean, we
could have used a few more people to search for balls, but other than that, nothing.
We won't need crowd control if you play this weekend. So,
all right, good. Well, we'll keep it a secret for the time being.
Yeah.
And yeah. I appreciate the invite, although it isn't formal yet. I'll anticipate it.
What do you mean it's not formal? You want it engraved? You want it hand delivered?
Well, something wrong with that?
You want me to fly your British Airways from where your house to my house?
Depends on where we're playing, John.
Well, we're playing in the West End, Bob.
Well, I don't do the West End yet.
Wow.
You know, I'm moving soon, and then I will play the West End.
Okay. So in our huge and important and elongated production meeting before this show,
yes,
we were supposed to talk about the Montreal Canadiens.
Well, that lasted about 3 seconds. Well, and I think we should, because you know, this team has done not much wrong in the last 7 games. And I know everybody's going to think this is a big upset, and I probably should too, but I don't know what this team reached its peak. Are they going to be unable to beat? Well, if it's Tampa, if it's
it's Colorado. They have to play. They play Colorado or Vegas. The winner of Colorado or Vegas.
You'd make them a huge underdog against either of those two teams, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Sure. They were underdog against the Maple Leafs. They were underdogs against the Jets.
And in a year where nobody's played anybody else interdivisionally, how the hell do we know?
Yeah, we don't. You don't
like points and standings during the regular season essentially mean nothing.
Yeah, and to be clear, I did pick the Jets to win in six. But if Montreal had won in six, I don't think many people would have been overly shocked. But they won in four straight games, Bob. Well, they never did not have the lead. That's a double negative. They always had the lead.
Yeah. Every game they
always had the lead. Yeah. It's phenomenal. And it's more than Carey Price. You know, Shea Weber has played great. Their young guys, Caulfield, Suzuki, Kakiemeni, have played great. Corey Perry's playing like a 26-year-old, not a 36-year-old.
I know.
I mean, they I was on record all season long thinking the Winnipeg Jets might have been the deepest team in hockey. I think Montreal's deeper right now. I think they played deeper. They played their four lines. I'm not sure who you can tell me who the first line was from the fourth line and vice versa.
Well, I've said it before. I'll say it again. This was a team that went through challenges over the course of the regular season, and I think mm-hmm. we underestimated them.
Yeah.
Collectively. And perhaps they are this good. I'm not positive, but maybe they are this good, John. Yeah. And maybe they can beat a Colorado or a Vegas. I'm not putting anything past them now.
Well, when you have Carey Price as your goaltender, you have a chance. You really do. And their defense has played stellar. Their defense has played so well, Bob.
Well,
even without Jeff Petrie in game four, they were able to put in Brett Kulak to play a little more time. Young Alex Romanoff played very well for the brief time that he played there. You know, the momentum of winning and confidence has really been great for Montreal. And they were full marks for the victory again last night, even though Winnipeg did make a game of it. And the goal was in overtime that eventually won the series.
Well, we will see what happens next, but this is this is the story right now, I would say.
So if you're Dom Ducharme and Marc Bergevin, knowing what you know about between the Toronto series and the Winnipeg series, how much time do you want off? Would you like to be playing tomorrow night, or are you happy to wait until perhaps the weekend?
Look, like you, I have never played in a Stanley Cup playoff series, so I can only go by what history suggests. And there is a consensus that you don't, when you're playing well, you don't want to be off too long. One extra day, two extra days, that's fine. If it gets to 4, 5, 6, now you run the risk of getting stale.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what's worse. Vegas played a tough 7-game series against Minnesota and then laid a complete egg in game one against Colorado and then marched back.
Mm-hmm. Colorado, conversely, sat for I think 8 days.
Yeah,
and looked like 7-1, but have not looked very good since.
So what's the correct answer?
I really don't know. I don't know. I think that the only thing Montreal has to be happy for is that Jeff Petrie, who was injured in game three, will be healthy enough to play at the start of the next series, they hope, which is a real positive for them.
Yeah, but I'm not sure they couldn't win without him. They've got that magic. And you know, if you think Montreal's a mediocre team, I mean, they're not a bad team. They made the playoffs. But if you think they're just mediocre team and just on one of those runs, and teams mm-hmm. go on these runs,
yep.
then maybe the sword of Damocles is hanging over their head and the magic will eventually, you know, leave. But I'm unsure of that.
We're going to start hearing and seeing a lot more comparisons to the 93 team now.
It wasn't a dissimilar team. Had a good
there was that 7-game series that started it in 93 against Quebec that ended up being overtime winners that made the difference. And then what happened in the third round, Bob, is that that was the year our buddy Glenn Healy played so well in the second round and the Islanders beat the Penguins. And therefore, Montreal had a much easier row to hoe to go to the Stanley Cup final. They played the Islanders, Patrick Waugh versus Glenn Healy, need I say any more. And then they played LA in the final, with due respect to our buddy Glenn Healy. But so you wonder.
Gretzky, who had beaten the Maple Leafs in
seven. That's right, seven games. But Montreal won the final in five games that year.
So. Yeah. We'll discuss some hockey stuff. The Boston Bruins on the precipice of being eliminated by the aforementioned Islanders. The Celtics are...
Boston-Montreal. Boston-Montreal would have been a great final if it could have worked out.
Well, they hate each other.
Yeah.
The Celtics see Danny Ainge leave and promote a, I think, beleaguered head coach to president. Mm-hmm. Well, that's weird.
Yeah.
And the Boston Red Sox are playing okay. But in a city that is used to success, maybe they're taking a bit of a hit now with their two winter teams, one winter team gone and the other winter team on the verge of going. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe will join us when we come back after these messages. It's a Tuesday. Still Tuesday, John? I think it's still Tuesday.
Still Tuesday all day, Bob.
Okay, good. It's Bob McCown. It's John Shannon on the program. And with us, one of our favorites from the Boston Globe, Bob Ryan, is with us. This is an unusual time for Boston sports fans, Mr. Ryan, who've been spoiled beyond belief for the past decade or so. Their Celtics are gone. The Bruins are on the precipice. I guess the Red Sox are playing okay, but not sure how long that will be sustainable. Let's begin with the situation with the Celtics. The Danny Ainge departure, surprising or was it anticipated?
Let me just say before we address that, with regard to the general situation in Boston, obviously people are spoiled. Obviously, a day of reckoning had to come sooner or later. We have been the most blessed city in all of North America since the 21st century, with 12 parades, 6 other trips to the finals. And I'm not even counting the MLS. We had 3 trips to those finals too. Oh, and a few college national championships. Okay. Now, the Celtics. It was the timing of it all within literally now 12 to 14 hours after the final game, there was a press conference. The word had dribbled out in the morning that Danny was leaving and Brad was taking over. The idea that Danny was leaving was not a total shock, unnecessarily. He had been on the job 18 years. We knew that there was a heart situation. He actually was asked a direct question. The first question at this press conference, is this health related? And I'm somewhat surprisingly, I thought, he said yes. He acted in the affirmative. He's had two heart attacks, one at age 50, one at age 60. And when he had the second one 2 years ago, his family really was upset. And Danny made an allusion to that, that the stress of the job, et cetera, they were concerned about him. Okay, Danny leaving, and I don't think he's leaving basketball forever. I think, you know, at the least he'll be a Jerry West-like consultant for somebody down the road. I wouldn't, he's only 62. Okay, the other thing though, number one, there was a lot of people circling back and pointing at Brad because of the circumstance of the team being a highly underachieving team, made arguably the most disappointing team in the entire NBA this year, although the book isn't closed on the Clippers yet. But I think the Celtics have qualified. The idea that Brad at age 44 would leave coaching and take this front office job and left unspoken, unasked, and therefore unanswered was the following. Brad, does this mean you're never going to coach again? You're 44 and you claim you love coaching. I can't believe that's the case, that this is a lifer job now as an executive, that at 44, he won't coach at some level again. But that question wasn't asked and it wasn't answered. That's the shock that we didn't know. I don't think there's a person in the media anywhere that ever projected Brad in this job this young, at this young age.
Well, that said, Danny Ainge was 44 when he took over the Celtics.
Oh, no, I know that. No, my point is, and that the Brad has been a coach and only right. a coach as a adult. He did actually work in private business briefly after graduation from DePaul University, DePaul W, not DePaul L. And he worked for Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, briefly. And then he couldn't resist the coaching. The bug bit him and he got into college coaching and we all know what happened there. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. Danny had coached with the Suns. And anyway, Danny was young. Yeah, exactly right. 40, same age, 44 when he got this job. And no one saw that coming either, John. That right. was a shock. He was out in Phoenix. He hadn't had a Boston connection since he had left the Celtics in 89 when he was traded to Sacramento. So that's a long period of time that he had no Boston connection and suddenly he was back. And this was very stealthily done. The management then that hired him gave new clues that Danny Ainge was going to be their guy. So anyway, but all I'm saying is I just can't personally believe that Brad Stevens will never coach again. So I don't know how long he intends to do this job. Right now, of course, it's open-ended. He just started. And I think he has every opportunity to be good at it. He's a very bright guy. And he's had 8 years in the league experience, and he understands how this league works now. And he certainly knows what's on this particular team and who these guys are. Anyway, but that's the unanswered question. Brad, what are you going to be doing in 10 years, 15 years? I can't believe he's going to be sitting in an office.
Well, from the outside looking in, Mr. Ryan, you had to think that Stevens' job as coach was on the line this year. There was lots of talk, babble about, you know, he has to do something this year to kind of earn another deal. And I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but that was sort of the consensus. To go from your job is on the line as head coach to another disappointing season, which you have acknowledged, and then to be essentially elevated to president of the club is a curious, curious scenario. One that I don't recall ever seeing before.
You are correct. I was going to ask you if you could cite anything in hockey. I know of nothing in baseball, basketball, or football.
That's I don't great. Know one.
Nope. Okay, here's something that I didn't take into immediate consideration that was pointed out to me, and it was, of course, Money. They owe him $30 million. And even if they were unhappy or decided that that him as a coach and that time to move on, they found a job for him that he is possibly qualified to do. And they owe him a lot of money. I hadn't, my initial reaction, I just didn't, so maybe that's the simple answer. That they're going to pay him. They weren't going to pay him not to coach, but they'll pay him to run the team. I mean, I'm throwing it out there.
Yeah.
Well,
so, hey, so,
Will he, under his title, or do you know, will he have control over personnel?
I believe he will, because I don't, these owners have not proven, they've not in any way been meddlesome. They certainly went with Danny. They gave Danny a full authority to do whatever he wanted. Obviously, you couldn't, you know, ultimately they have to sign the checks, but and sign off ultimately, but that's true in any organization. No, I think Danny had full autonomy, and I think that Brad will have, I would assume that Brad will have a similar autonomy.
Bob, what will Danny's legacy be as the Celtics president, Celtics general manager?
I hope that people will view it, that the majority, that the all the thinking people, and I think the thinking people will view it as a success. Yes, only one championship in 18 years. However, it's the only one in 35 years. He did produce one. Other than that, you got to go back to 1986. And so one in 35 years. And we, of course, look, I'm rationalizing. I was there and watching it happen. This is true. Many other teams and many other sports can launch a similar argument as the one I'm about to make. There was a window of 3 to 5 years. They achieved the goal in the first year, won 66 games after winning like 32 the year before. Okay. And it was a really good team. They were, I believe, the best team in 09. They won 62 games the second year. And then Kevin Garnett got hurt, was not available to play in the last two rounds. And they got beat by Orlando. They were better than Orlando with Garnett. I mean, no, any intelligent person knows that. They were the best team that year. They didn't win because of that injury. That was an untimely injury. The next year against the Lakers, they're up 3-2. They're going back to L.A. Kendrick Perkins gets hurt in game 6. And all they needed from Rasheed Wallace, who had stayed out of shape the whole year, just being basically a clown figure, you know, stealing money from them, was one game. Give us one game, for God's sake, Rasheed. And he couldn't do it. Even then, give the Lakers credit. The Celtics were up by 3 points in the fourth quarter. And in three possessions, John and Bob, totaling 94 seconds on the clock, they went from +3 to -6 and never recovered. And the catalyst was a guy who had many big shots in that era for the Lakers. Derek Fisher comes down, walks right into a three, and started the run, and the Lakers won that game. They could have. There was a 3-year window where they were arguably the best team. They got it done once. All right. So, and then there was a little resurgence now when we hired Brad, and they got the three conference finals, and that should be considered to be a successful tenure, I think.
Boston fans are known for not being short of opinion and not being particularly sympathetic. How are they reacting to this Stevens situation? Are they acceptant of the situation, or are they up in arms?
There's goodwill here, I think, first of all, generally speaking, surrounding both parties, Danny and Brad. Right. Also, management are not viewed in any odious manner here. The management has succeeded in as much as I won't say they're beloved, but they're politely tolerated by the fans in a way that a lot of managements and a lot of sports aren't. You know, they seem to be fairly trustworthy in that regard. I think people are getting over the strangeness of that you alluded to in the beginning. We've never seen this particular juxtaposition. And you are right, by the way, I'm going to circle back. There were a lot of people, you know, ready to point fingers at Brad as he couldn't reach these guys any longer. Well, you know, we know that there's that phenomenon is ever growing, that it is a time limit on how long your voice is relevant to a group. And I give you Exhibit A, the 76ers, they were a group of people that needed a new voice, and Doc Rivers needed a new set of ears. And they were a very propitious marriage. Although they're going to fight their very to the death with the Hawks. I know that anyway. But so people were talking. I think people are, there's faith that, you know, Brad, everybody understands he's a bright guy, but it is, he's a rookie. He's a rookie in this job. And here's the, oh, by the way, in anticipation of a question that you might ask, I'm going to answer it. And that is, who's going to handle the draft? I asked Brad, I asked Danny, excuse me, I communicated with both of them. Danny's sticking around. He's going to help with the draft. Hmm. And then he goes bye bye. So he'll be there with the Danny.
That'll be helpful.
We can jointly evaluate the draft.
You know, you touched on those great teams of the late first decade of the century. You know, to me, when you had Garnett, Pierce, and Allen, that was the first vestige of the super teams, where you had the – and that was – and Danny Ainge orchestrated that. I mean, he was the guy that put that together, and everybody – it became such a copycat, and to the point where we're almost seeing the end of it now.
Yeah, that was and that's where Danny deserves all the credit that we want to give him. But let's just dissect that. He had the fifth pick in the draft on that June night in 2007. He sent that pick to Seattle for Ray Allen. Only because he had Ray Allen was he able to persuade Kevin Garnett, who had full approval, to come. Never would have come if they didn't already have Allen. Now, a lot of people, some jokingly, some seriously, say it was a total gift from Kevin McHale, his buddy, because they are friends and they always were, and he helped him out. Well, Danny had something. He had a commodity that Kevin McHale coveted. Al Jefferson. People forget Al Jefferson. He was a pretty good inside post player. And he was a draft pick out of high school, directly from a Texas town. I forget which one, Beaumont, maybe, I'm not sure. Anyway, Al Jefferson, and he was a commodity. He was a good, so he had something that was of value. And there were other picks, blah, blah. But anyway, Danny completely orchestrated that and transformed that team. And then added on with James Posey and Eddie House, without whom they don't win. You know, he made, and then finally, a P.J. Brown, who they got at the All-Star break by recruiting him. The old guys went and lobbied him and recruited him and said, come on, join us. And he did. He gets a game-winning basket against the Cavaliers in a tough series. So anyway, Danny, fingerprints, the entire thing comes back to Danny Ainge's like that.
Right.
This may seem like a bit of a stretch, but stick with me here for a second. Kyle Dubas, the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, might just well have looked at the NBA situation when he decided to put together the hockey club that exists here in Toronto, in that we have known for the last few years, more than few years, NBA teams want to go find two, preferably three stars, don't care how much of the cap they use up on those three guys, and just fill in the rest with whoever they can find. And it has demonstrated a level of success. It has not succeeded in Toronto, and we will wait and see in the hockey team. We'll see what happens as a result of that. But one of those super teams who won the championship a year ago got eliminated in the first round. That's the LA Lakers. You could argue that the Phoenix Suns might be in a position to win a championship, maybe. They aren't one of those teams. They got one big name guy that they went out and got, but New Jersey is that other team.
Brooklyn.
And
Brooklyn.
They're playing like crazy. We understand that. Is there a chance that this cycle that we seem to be in of go spend whatever you have to on two or three guys and don't worry about the rest? Are we sure that's going to survive in the NBA?
No, because I believe that all these things are cyclical and circumstantial.
I do too.
And that one of my favorite phrases, Bob and John, is everything is true till it's not true. If you win 99 in a row, fine, but you may lose that 100th. You know, I'm saying this is the same thing. First, it was two superstars, they said, and you could go back to the Bulls. Pippen was the Batman to the Robin to the Batman.
Yeah, you can.
You can go back to the Celtics, McHale. He had two, Parrish. He had two Hall of Famers. Then with throwing Walton, he had three, then throwing Dennis Johnson, he had four on the same, and more all-stars with Ainge and Redmond were each in all-star players at one point or another. Anyway, all right, point being.
Kobe and Shaq too, you had Kobe and Shaq.
Oh, yes, Kobe and Shaq was so fine. Then they said suddenly it's three, Well, we'll see. You mentioned the Nets. It's terrifying what they're capable of. What they're doing here without Harden, they humiliated a team last night of a team of consequence.
Milwaukee, yeah,
absolutely embarrass them. Now, let's see how I'll be very curious to see how Milwaukee responds to this. But anyway, I just don't think there's ever absolutes in this regard, Bob. There's different ways, the old different ways to skin a cat thing, whatever you want. I would love, frankly, you know, as a neutral now, I'm totally a neutral, except for emotional. Like, I'm a friend of Doc Rivers, so I would love to see him succeed. I love Rick. Well, Carlisle's going. I can't root for him anymore. Anyway, I'm just sitting back and enjoying it all, you know. And I've got my podcast. I need to know what's going on. I would love for either Phoenix or Utah to win and disprove the theory, you know. And I'd love that.
Yeah, and the only thing I'm gonna stand up and point a finger at is you talked about Jordan and Pippen, for example. Well, they didn't go out and get either one of those guys deliberately.
Right. It's a different right.
You know, Bird and et cetera. Shaq was traded to LA, if I remember correctly.
Free agent.
He was a free agent?
He was a free agent.
Okay.
Kobe was traded to LA.
Kobe was traded on draft night for Vlade Divac.
As an 18.
Vlade Divac.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but you're right. And they were there, as my mother would say, they weren't store-bought teams. They were organic, more organic. Yeah,
and these teams that we're seeing now are free agent acquisitions.
It's LeBron who got it done with Wade and Bosch. He went with Wade, who had won one on his own. When we didn't have this theory, and the year before, and when they won it, he was the star of stars. There was nobody, you know, I can't even tell you who was the second best player on the team off the top of my head right now. It was all about Wade. And then they got Bosch, and you know, Bosch was not considered to be on that level, but he was certainly a good wingman. That was the one, that's where all this got started, you know. And then Durant exacerbated everything by going to Golden State. You know, and he's so shocked to this day, he's so sensitive that people didn't like it, that people felt he was just piling on. And he'll never get over it. He's not over it. The criticism, he'll go to take it to his grave. He'll be bitter and angry about the world who won't give him his due, in a sense, his right to do what he wanted to do, blah, 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 blah. So I just say this is very fluid. I let's just, for sake of argument, if Phoenix and Utah, either it does win. Is this going to silence and people are going to, you have to go that way. No, it's a method. I don't think there's a guaranteed method. There's
more
logical.
Right.
I mean, but what the Nets have done, you know, with the three of them is that you can live with two of them. Right now, I can't get in. First of all, no one can get inside Kyrie's head. Let's start with that. That's the greatest abstract in sports, getting inside Kyrie's head. I am not saying, guys, that Kyrie is welcoming the absence of Harden. I'm not going to say that. But I am going to say what he's saying is, hey, I got this. No big deal. We're okay. We'll be fine. Me and Kevin and Joe Harris and we're okay. I can control this. He's playing at extraordinary level of his size, his position. He can't play better at 6'2", whatever he is, than he's playing right now.
Well, he's not short of self-confidence, you would acknowledge. And that goes back to his Cleveland days playing with LeBron. You know, he didn't really like being the second banana.
He has never, to my knowledge, categorically stated in public why he left Cleveland. We assume we know. You just said it. But he's never said the words, you know, but we kind of figure we know, you know.
Well, if you remember the end of that series,
it seems to be right now, you know, simpatico with Durant on this level. You know, I don't know if he figures Durant is 90% of him or 88% of him or 92-4, but he's willing to accept Durant as a reasonable co-equal. But I think, you know, he wants that ball for that last shot if it comes down to that.
100%.
Where do you think Steve Nash fits into that equation?
Well, we wondered, because he was a rookie coach, about whether it would be a hindrance. Steve Nash may be another anomaly. He's a Hall of Fame player. He's a people guy. Everyone agreed he was a coach on the floor. And I think he's as successful of handling this particular situation as any first-year coach could possibly be. I think he gets a lot of credit for understanding these guys and understanding the situation. I think he's, from afar, I have to applaud the job he's done. People say, you know, One thing I did learn a long time ago you know, a lot of guys can coach up mediocre, you know, bad teams into mediocre teams, or mediocre teams into pretty good teams. But when you're dealing with the ultimate talents, it's such a psychology job. It's not about X's and O's. And this is why Auerbach was successful in his day. It's why Phil Jackson was successful in his day. They understood how to relate. I don't want to say handle. Reddy was the first person to say, I don't handle people. You know, I don't handle Bill Russell, but I understand, you know, how to work with Bill Russell, get the most out of him. And I think this is what, and not everybody was capable, but I can think of coaches over the years who even won Coach of the Year honors by taking a team from, you know, that was supposed to be pretty good and make them pretty damn good, but not good enough to win the championship. And how often does the coach of the team with the best record totally get ignored by voters and that Coach of the Year award, you know, because that's not the way they look at it. They assume you're supposed to be good.
Have you thought about in today's game with players today, all of whom will know that Steve Nash is a two-time MVP and was a great player and et cetera, et cetera. Does that add a level of respect on the part of the players today, or are they so self-absorbed that they only care about themselves?
In the pages of my newspaper, the Boston Globe, this very morning, there is an allusion to the idea that it might be propitious of the director of basketball operations, Stevens, to select as his successor a former NBA player who can command the respect of the two stars of the team automatically by walking in the doors.
You're just interesting.
So that is Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. It is not a given, but that was a supposition that would be necessary. Interesting in that if you study work on it in a column I wrote for the late lamented Basketball Times within the last year, studying the nature of the new crop of NBA coaches, the current landscape of NBA coaches, and how many of them are people who, if they walk down the street of any city in America, including their own, would completely pass in anonymity. Right. Some of them come and go. Mike Budenholzer, Terry Stotts was 9 years. Oh, no, he wasn't. Lloyd Pierce, who got fired. Steve Clifford, you know, there's all these guys. I can't even name all the guy in Oklahoma City, Daniel. I don't even know him. I have no idea. But a lot of them started out. Oh, Eric Spoelstra was Exhibit A. He started out as a video coordinator kind of thing. And they worked their way through the ranks without ever having been a star player.
Well, I think you could put Nick Nurse in that list and Frank Vogel.
And he won the championship. I mean, when Nick, I happened to be in Des Moines the day he was appointed coach of the Iowa Energy, which is another story entirely. And that's the first day I ever heard of him. Okay. I didn't know who he was. And I looked him up and, oh my God, he's in England, you know? And yeah, Nick Nurse, this is a more of a pattern of the coaching path today. But if the Nets win and Nash is, you know, in his first year is supervising this championship, you know, that might spark but once again, it's all cyclical. It's all, I don't think there's ever an absolute, but it's a logical way to go, you know, to get a guy who's a professional, I mean, a player of some stature that the players would respect. And I think, Bob, in more cases than not, it is advisable, you know, depending on the group you've got. For example, now, one other aspect, one of the things that's been thrown out there, Brad promised diversity. We know the Celtics have had a relationship with Kara Lawson. And we also know that Becky Hammon is going to be, I think, going to be a coach in this league someday. Everybody thought it might be obviously San Antonio because that's, but point is, if it happens, a great groundwork's got to be done to make sure you got the right group that will accept the idea of taking orders from a female, as whatever her credentials. If it's going to happen, I think there are groups theoretically that would be amenable, and I think there are groups theoretically that would not.
Would Boston be the place for the first female head coach in the NBA?
Well, Kara Lawson, if it's to be she, apparently impressed one and all, and the players have professed some, you know, outward public respect for her. Maybe they might. They might be. A group that would be the proper place to be the lab experiment that this would be. Let's face it would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
Boston's not known to be the progressive city over the last 60 years.
That's my point. Yeah. Well, that's my point. Yeah.
Well, race is one thing, and we can't, you know, we can talk about that. And it is, you know, we're not in a good circumstance thanks to one clown that threw a bottle at Kyrie, and we almost had a clean getaway, if you will. But as far as gender is concerned, you know, everyone's an open slate. No one knows.
More to discuss, a little basketball, but some other things too. Bob Ryan is with us back after these messages. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Before we get off basketball, although we may continue, who knows?
Well, I want to hear how Kawhi's going to blow up. And exactly where I was going to go.
If the Clippers implode, and there's every reason to believe that that's possible, does Kawhi stay?
I would bet against it.
Really?
I would think he would.
Do you think he goes up the road to LA? Other LA team?
Well, the thing is about, he'd have to look at the thing in a sober light of day. LeBron is never going to be the LeBron of, again, at 37. He turns 37 on December 30th. We see that he's susceptible to annual injury now. And you know, and we all know that injury is the reason why they're going home, but they're home. You know, number one, the injury to the two stars. I think they're past tense Lakers right now. There's no guarantee that Davis will. Oh, how about Charles Barkley's nickname? You heard it, right?
Yeah.
It's going to stick with him. I think Mr. Street Clothes. I don't know that that's the place he'd be looking at. Maybe a pile-on thing, you know, maybe, you know, some other identifiable, you know, hey, how about throw him into the Hawks? Put him with Trae Young. How's that? You know, I'm just saying.
I don't think
LA, the Lakers are the destination of the future.
Maybe Phoenix even.
Oh, even Phoenix, of course. Now, speaking of Kawhi, boy, when he enters that zone, he's in it. Oof. He's back in it. He's back in that championship zone you knew 2 years ago. Is there a better, technically speaking, two-way player in the league?
No.
I don't think so. Below center. He's the most proficient defender who can get you 35 or 40, and the most proficient guy who can get you 35 or 40 who can shut down a great player on the other end. And he stuck in 9 assists the other day when we weren't looking. You know, so he's in that zone right now.
Well, you guys mentioned Los Angeles. You guys mentioned Phoenix. I'm sorry, I have to mention it. Why not Toronto?
Well, and I was going to go there because, you know, there has been lots of chatter around here about
wishful thinking more so, but yeah,
that's the point. There's no chance that Kawhi is coming back here, in my opinion. I mean, he had his chance. He had his choice. He had a good team around him. He won a championship and he wanted to live in LA. Now, I don't know. Can you take a helicopter from his West Coast pad to Phoenix to play home games? I don't know.
Not quite.
Not quite. I know. But I'll tell you, I've got my eye on them. I'm curious now. Obviously, we all wrote them off totally after games 1 and 2. And look what they've done.
They're not dead.
As the king said, and King and I, they're a puzzlement. They are a puzzlement, folks. And I they will remain so until we see the horn sound on whatever is the final game of their season. They're an inexplicable puzzlement.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera, et cetera. Very good. Yes.
You're welcome. let's swing gears here a little bit in the couple of minutes we've got left. How do you feel about your Red Sox team? I didn't expect a whole lot from them. I'm a little shocked that they played as well as they have. Is it sustainable? Are you starting to believe?
A little bit, because the thing is that they have, in the modern world of how pitching staffs function, looking for 5 innings, 6 is great, 7 is a dream, 9 is unimaginable. But, you know, build around bullpens. They've had as one of the more stable rotations so far in all of baseball. I just saw some metrics on it yesterday, I think. One of the 2 or 3 most stable rotations from day one so far, which is not expected. Last year, they were horrible. It was awful. And this is without Chris Sale. This is a pie. Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting anything out of him, but he could be ready by August. They're just saying that. They're saying, okay, he still hasn't thrown off a mound, guys. He's throwing the baseball anyway. Okay. And Matt Barnes has rediscovered himself and is a legitimately lights out closer who finished off one of the Yankee games this weekend by striking out the side on 12 pitches. He's having a terrific year. Although he gave up a run the other day and that cost him forced him to win in the 10th inning, but he's been great. Three players in the lineup have been, utterly tremendous. JD Martinez, as we discovered himself after a wipeout year last year. Bogarts, who's continually establishing himself as one of the best players in all of baseball, a premier shortstop, is having another fine year. And Rafael Devers, when the bat hits the ball or the ball hits the bat, it generally goes off at a very high rate of speed. He doesn't get bloop singles. he's a damn good threat. Now guys are coming out. Hunter Renfro is starting to play well. They're going to be heard from. I wouldn't rank them as I think they can hang. Yes, I do. I think they can.
This may be a slightly unfair question because I don't know how often you've seen him play. But very quietly, or maybe not so quietly, Vladdy Guerrero here in Toronto is emerging as one of the great players in baseball and has a chance, honestly, to be the best player in the game for a number of years. As a longtime baseball guy, give me your take on what you've seen from Vladdy.
I'm following it from afar. They're in town. They're coming to town the weekend. I'll be there. Yeah. I'll be there at least two of the three games over the next coming weekend. And I'm looking forward to this. I know he went and lost. He got himself some personal discipline. He obviously got himself, if you follow baseball at all, if you're a Baseball America person, which I am, we're well aware of this coming phenomenon, Vladdy Jr.
Okay. Oh, we've been hearing about him for 6 years, seven years. Okay.
So, I was aware of him. And then, we know how it's progressed. And we know he needed to lose weight. And he did. He acquired some personal discipline. And now we're seeing the results. I'm impressed. I mean, we got, he's American Leagues. We got him here. And nationally, they got Tatis Jr. How about all these sons, of course, the sons of players that are making their mark, including mm-hmm. three on one team, as you well know,
Oh, yeah.
But I love it. But I'm looking forward to seeing him in person. You're right. I haven't seen a game. I only know what I've been reading, but I've been reading it from day one. And I look at the numbers and good for him. Daddy was and is like father, like son. You don't have to throw a strike for him to swing the bat.
The key thing in all of it really is we all knew the bat was there, but he's finally comfortable in the infield at first base. Well, and that really has changed the whole perspective, I think.
Well, there you go with the weight loss too. He's obviously more nimble, sure. More confident, more comfortable. I mean, now what's it say about the Adelus? Is that number correct? 40? Are we buying whatever? Well, that's a lot. the last guy, like Prince Fielder level, right? And he never did it, did he? He really never did take that step. No. Okay.
I got a question for you, Mr. Ryan, as a something of an historian. Vladdy, at last look, led in all categories for the Triple Crown. Has anybody ever won a Triple Crown and a Gold Glove in the same year?
To the best of my knowledge, no. Although I'd have to look that up, but I can't think of anything because first of all, Triple Crowns are very rare to start with. Okay. Secondly, the Gold Glove wasn't instituted until the late 60s or somewhere mm-hmm. in there to start with. So that would preclude all the pre 1960 guys, the Ted Williamses and the Rogers Hornsby's and the others. Sure. Now I'm thinking in 1966, Yaz in 67 was probably very possibly, if they had a Gold Glove, he was winning it in left field. I'm sure.
That's why.
Check it out. The year before, Frank Robinson, I don't think he was going to get a Gold Glove at that age, but in right field. But Yaz certainly is one thing that would come to mind. Yeah. We could look it up.
Quickly. Well, we're 50 something games into the season. So yeah. I'm not projecting anything.
That's a tribute. That's tremendous. Yeah. Tremendous.
He's playing. I mean, when you get a chance to see him play, boy, I'll tell you, he is. And John alluded to it. The bat is one thing, and we knew that was coming. We saw it from the time the kid was 15 years old or whatever. We've been hearing about him, but we also heard he was he was a mediocre to crummy defensive third baseman, and he
was.
Yeah. He was. But they moved him over to first base with the intent probably of, we'll try him there because we don't really want to DH a 22-year-old for his whole career. The kid has been stellar defensively at first base.
Funny how sometimes they fool you. I'm very proprietary to a first baseman, being an old little league first baseman. I remember I was taught footwork by my coach when I was 10 years old about how to straddle the bag. I never had to worry about holding the runner because, you know, you don't run in a little league. Anyway, I'm really proprietary, and I love good first baseman, you know, what they can bring. They can really enhance an entire infield. Obviously, you can enhance bad throws and all. But, you know, I see some of the great ones. We had George Scott was another big guy that had quick feet, great feet. But so they'll fool you sometimes. Euclid was a terrific first baseman. You wouldn't have thought so at all. We had, you know, so I'm happy for him. That's good. And I like watching good first baseman.
Time is our enemy, and I know you have things to do. I consider this for the next time we chat. I would like you to do some research and explore the magic dust that the Tampa Bay Rays manage to sprinkle every year, because we don't talk enough about this. They bring competitive, very good teams out of nowhere over and over again. And they do it with different coaches and different general managers.
Yeah, I know.
And I can't figure it out, and I'm hoping you can explain.
All right,
I won't put you on the spot.
No, that's a very good one. It is remarkable. What frustrates and really angers me is that they are, with the old phrase, pearls before swine. That team deserves a better audience. They play in the worst ballpark in baseball, period. There's no second. Everything else is tied for second place. And in front of an unappreciative constituency, there's no reason for that franchise to exist. It's had enough time to prove that baseball means something. And I'm tired of this excuse about the location. It's the only excuse you get, you know, is that they're on the wrong side of the bay. Yeah, they are, I'm sure, but damn it, that team's so good all the time. It deserves a better constituency. That's what drives me crazy.
Baseball.
Hey, Bob, I was going to say, some people are saying they're on the wrong side of the border.
Well, baseball fans in Montreal should be lusting after the possibility of getting that franchise.
Well, we can have that. I'm long on this, you know, long on record as lamenting what happened to the Expos.
We all are. Mr. Ryan, thank you so much for your time.
Great to be with you guys. This is fun.
Bob Ryan, back after these. So again, our thanks to Bob Ryan.
Oh, it's great to hear him. Isn't it great to hear him?
Oh, yeah. He'll always give you something with intellect. He, you know, there's lots of guys know their stuff, unlike you, Shannon. But Ryan tells you stuff, and I just instantly believe it. And there's an historical reference to it. It's one of the great things about.
When you think about it, particularly when it comes to the NBA, when he can sit here and wax poetic about, Red Auerbach.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, of a different time. And I'm a sports historian. I love those kind of stories, because those were, when I was a kid, those guys were on huge pedestals. And I didn't know anything about the inner workings of professional sports. I know a little bit more now. And so I still revel in hearing about the guys like Auerbach and Jerry West as a player, not necessarily as a manager. That to me, that always excites me about Bob and when he comes on.
Well, look, at for young people who subscribe to this podcast, watch this on YouTube or wherever whatever they do. I think if you're a real sports fan, context is important, and mm-hmm. to have somebody who can talk to you about the days that you will never remember because you weren't here for them, right, and relate it to what's going on now,
wow,
is of extraordinary value. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, when I was a young kid and interested in sports, I loved to hear from the older guys who could tell you stuff about what went on. I mean, I remember growing up and wanting to know everything I could about the Brooklyn Dodgers, and there's a long story behind that. And to hear guys who actually saw Babe Ruth play, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's great value in that. And I don't mean to ask Mr. Ryan as being aged, but.
But you used a word, Bob, that does not get enough usage in our world, in sports at all, and that is context. Context never gets used enough. Even on broadcasts that we're watching now, somebody says, "Well, you know, the puck control time for the New York Islanders was 8 minutes." Yeah, compared to what? Who cares? Yeah. What's the context? Where's the context in all of these stories? So I can make a rational, relevant decision. They're better. Context is one of those words that we're always trying to say. Compared to what? Give me context. That's so important.
Well, I'm pleased you like my choice of word, but it's the one thing that's the word that pops up when I think of Bob Ryan, which is why we love having him on. In any event,
agreed.
We've chatted too much.
John Davidson tomorrow, Bob.
Yeah,
John Davidson.
And his return to Columbus. It's a phrase heretofore I don't think has ever been used. We will chat with him tomorrow. Until then, fond adieu. Goodbye, everybody.